Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Hey, welcome back to The Collaboration, which is Lawrence McKenna and Jamie Slevin.
Slevin.
It's a great name. We are here to have some non-hyperbolic debate. Hyperbolic debate. Maybe my mouth self-censors now. About Man City and then who is competing with them. But specifically right now, Man City. Because after all the results they've had recently, bad results on a string of games of Premier League matches. But also at the same time, at the start of the season, I was like, yeah, I guess they still do retain it. There are multiple symptoms of a bad season. Am I wrong?
Yeah, there's like the classic indicators.
Yeah, like... I think first we have to return to last summer, what happened last summer at Man City. And I think I always go back to it, the Jude Bellingham issue. Jude Bellingham, I think, probably strung a number of clubs along all at one point, right? Liverpool felt they probably got him at one point, hence why bids went in. You don't bid for a player in Liverpool unless you think you've got him. Man City felt very confident, is what I'm told, which is fair enough. Like, you would be, you're Man City. You are coming off the back of a pretty good season. And you know that there is a midfield rebuild on the cards, right? Because you know that people like Gundogan possibly going to leave. You know that people like Bernardo Silva probably looking at maybe a Barcelona little move, just something smart. You know that you're losing in your midfield. Yeah, like, you possibly want to get rid of Phillips. Joao Cancelo is probably on the way out. What you need is an incredibly adaptable leader who's probably going to be there for generations. Jude Bellingham fits that as a model. But in the end, he ends up going to Real Madrid. And, you know, obviously he's played fantastically there. Seems like a very natural fit now. And, you know, retrospectively, we can all fit that as fantastic. But when they missed out on him, I think it did mess up their summer.
Yeah, well, they went in the end for Nunes. Not the Liverpool version, but the Wolves version.
Feels like a panic buy to me.
Yeah, it felt like he was third down the list, and they wanted Paqueta as well.
So I don't think that their pursuit of him is over. I just think that it's probably on ice until they know guilty, not guilty, whatever.
But it speaks to the fact they probably weren't expecting to have to do their business so late.
Right.
And they were expecting that midfield player probably to look like Jude Bellingham. The other thing I just add is, and we'll get onto this, Rodri, or not having Rodri has been a problem, mm-hmm. but Gundogan played there last year for them. And in losing Gundogan, but not offloading Phillips or finding like an upgrade, they found themselves a little bit without balance, which is why you see them start 6 centre halves.
You kind of, I guess in my mind, I thought, I see Pep moving to much more of a ball carrying system, which speaks to where the game's at right now, I guess. And I guess you try and retrospectively fit things. You sort of go, oh, he's buying these guys. He's a genius. There must be something that's going to kind of instantly fit together. And it didn't. Like, or at least it hasn't very well so far. But I can't work out whether that's... I don't think that's down to the signings. I think that's down to a wider issue at the club right now and almost like the playing template that they have.
So I think there's two interpretations of City at the moment. Okay. One is you say that over-reliance on Rodri, the centre-backs, be that Ake and Akanji, don't do the John Stones role as well as John Stones does. As good as Alvarez has been, they're missing De Bruyne. And he needs to fix it or they're going to finish second, third, fourth. Take your pick. They're not going to win the league.
Which is then mixed in with the fact that last season they were treble, probably quadruple candidates, but treble winners. It feels like underachievement and it certainly feels like a stumble rather than... I don't know what the wording is. Like, I'm trying to find the right wording for something that's more less than a stumble, but not quite.
A stutter.
Yeah, a stutter, something like that. And it shouldn't be that way because I felt that City for years had had this kind of seamless transition or felt what felt like a relatively seamless transition between eras, especially under Pep, who's built and built and built.
Well, I think there is another interpretation of them that denies them that stutter.
Okay.
And says, look, it's an unfortunate couple of weeks they've had, but they're still likely to win the Premier League and they're still A-OK.
Do you think they're most likely still to win the Premier League, considering the recent form, considering they were beat by Arsenal, considering they were just beat the other night, considering they were beat before that, considering draws feel like losses now in the Premier League, and Arsenal... No, I mean, you know, people are saying, oh, this is the same as last year, you know, City stumbled last year or started slow. This is more than a slow start. I'm not saying therefore it's not possible, but this is definitely beyond a slow start and it's definitely not what we saw City last season doing. And I think it feels a lot harder to remedy this.
I don't know is the answer, but let me try and argue that they're just doing their thing, their slow start.
Okay.
And flesh out what that interpretation looks like. It's not just last year they struggled at the start of the season. It feels like sort of three out of the last four seasons. They've been relatively so slow to start. It feels like they lose at Southampton every year. And Newcastle, they lost it this year in the cup and blah, blah, blah.
And just, yeah, multiple weird results.
Yeah.
Like just weird results where you go, that's so unlike you.
I think what is definitely true is they're over-reliant on a couple of players. Rodri is the obvious one. They've lost the last five without him. And they're undefeated in, I think, 38 with him across all competitions. They're also over-reliant on John Stones. When John Stones doesn't play in there, Ake and Akanji look like, they look like learning how to walk, but in real time.
Yeah.
And they're doing it at St. James's Park, so it's a struggle. However, and this is the positive City case, when Rodri, John Stones and De Bruyne are back, and they just figure out a couple of the positional and structural issues, they are the only Premier League team, and I believe this, capable of going on a 10-game winning run, or a 12-game or 13-game winning
run. Interesting. So you don't, I mean, I think Arsenal maybe have that.
So Arsenal is the other one where there's two interpretations. Version one, look, not enough firepower. I know they beat Luton and Brentford, but only just. And like last year, they'll run out of steam. Or it's like, no. Arsenal have sorted out the defence. They're winning games they wouldn't have won last year. And come February, it's all going to click going forward. And whether you think City are going to win the league, I think it depends on which interpretation of Arsenal you buy.
Interesting. I think the bigger aspect for City, for Arsenal, for anyone who's competing for a title now is the games are a lot more competitive to me, or they feel a lot more competitive week in, week out. So, you know, a Luton is pushing Arsenal. I know in previous seasons there have been what we would call giant killings or whatever, but there feels like there is a lot more open games now and that's there to be exploited.
There's a top nine.
There's a top nine, but on top of that, there's also an openness to the games, which is, A, I think speaks to the quality improvement in the league and why more people are signing TV deals. And on top of that, like, I guess teams being more willing to play open football or play those risks, knowing if we go forward and do this, we can exploit them, you know, relying more, I guess, and trusting your players in an almost old school type feel. But it feels as if Pep doesn't quite trust his players this year, I think. Or not, and I'm not, you know, it's not like the breakdown of a marriage where someone's cheated. I don't think it's that, right? But I think there is this lack of, when there's lack of confidence, it becomes difficult to trust people. And if everyone doesn't have confidence in this system, or people are worried when a Rodri, De Bruyne, or especially John Stones and Rodri are out, it becomes a lot there becomes a lot more dependency between the positions. Having great technical players can make up the difference between, you know, having Rodri and not. But Rodri seems so specific to Pep, so important to have out on the field, that when you then introduce Doku, who I think is, he's excellent. He's an element of chaos that, and just an element of aggression and directness that Pep hasn't previously played with in to the same degree.
But not at City, at least.
Guardiola, who is incredibly, he's like generational for them, or will be in the end. I know it's easy to put people in those positions, but he's genuinely probably going to be there for, you know, a football generation at least. You'd hope for his sake and for their sake if they want to do well. Kovacic, I think, felt like an astute buy and still does. But again, things have to be kind of going better if you want Kovacic with a spotty injury record to be coming in and being able to put in those performances. You don't want to be putting the strain and the load on him. You want to be putting that on his counterpart, his other pivot, whatever you want to call them.
You know what's interesting is, like, Pep has been so committed to the system, you know, with this box and you've got the centre-halves tucking in, that he hasn't just gone, fuck, we'll go 4-2-3-1 and we'll play Calvin Phillips alongside Gundogan, Kovacic, and just have the two of them kind of collectively do the job Rodri was doing.
Yeah, like I get what you're saying. Like, collectively, it's very difficult to do those jobs. I think a lot of teams are finding that in the Premier League this season. Like, you know, Arsenal have replaced Partey and Xhaka, two very different players, to Kai Havertz and Rice. And collectively, they're asking people to do these kind of roles-driven positions. So it's no longer kind of they have a position, they have roles. And I know that's been the case for a while, but it seems more evident than ever in the midfield. But what Rodri was so sure of was his roles. And he was so good at enabling through that. He's a facilitator through making up.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you look at how City set up, obviously they have like your front three, which is Haaland, Alvarez, Foden, for example. But then you also have your Bernardo Silva plus one. So you end up with five quite attacking players on the pitch.
Yeah, and even then, I think there was a theory. I mean, if you then look at who, if you look at City's season so far, right? And we're talking about fitting pieces in here and all these kind of things. It's a very similar conversation to the conversation we were having around Liverpool last season. Liverpool, of course, last season, on the back of a potential quadruple. Not, do you know, yeah?
I mean, they were literally a game and 5 minutes away from a quadruple, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's prolific. Whether you win it or not, they were two games away. Yeah, like minutes, like you say. Pieces that you're trying to fit into a new system and possibly a position, a system where you're moving away from relationism, you know, and positionism. And those two are like coming at odds because Pepper's kind of trying. Now, here's what's interesting and the difference. Actually, very similar, actually. Pep is normally a very position-driven manager. We know that people are quite compelled to stay within their positions, stay within the system. It seems as if football is moving in the other way at the moment. And that means that positionism doesn't quite fit in and can't quite win you games in the same way. Sometimes Pep takes on extra homework, like that really talented kid at school. Like when he took on Haaland, it was sort of like, yeah, let's just see if a big man fits in. And that felt right last season. They really, that was the reason for the slow start last year, because they were really trying to push those pegs into those holes. But you could see they roughly fit. In this new system, it's kind of like, okay, so I lack a leader like Gundogan in the midfield. Don't have a Bellingham. We missed out on Rice. We bought Nunez as a panic buy, essentially. We've got people like Phillips still sticking around, who we knew we wanted to move on, is now on our wage bill, possibly taking up a spot that someone else could be taking up. We let João Cancelo go, who was a bit of a catch-all. We also let Cole Palmer go, who we wanted to offer an opportunity to, but ultimately bought in Doku, whatever you want to call him. And he then left for another opportunity. You know, could that be taking minutes off Haaland? Could that be a different type of forward?
I think you're right, apart from when everybody's fit. I think this Man City team, where De Bruyne, John Stones and Rodri play, and they still have the Alvarez, Foden, one of Doku and Grealish, I think works very, very well. And when I saw City play the other night against Tottenham on the Sunday, the commentator said, wow, Drury, I think it was, said, they are a different side. So last year, there were five monsters in the penalty area. And one of the things that you lose when you play so many centre-backs is possibly like the ability on the ball. Not in the case of John Stones, but certainly in the case of Ake or Kanji. But what you gain is defenders that love to defend. And the City team that won the treble with a lot of clean sheets on the basis that they were great in both boxes. I think the best of both worlds is probably possible. It just requires like three, essentially, Stones, Rodri, De Bruyne, all being fit. And when they're not, I think they look a little bit vulnerable off the ball.
Rodri especially. I think Rodri is the one they miss the most because Rodri can kind of cover a little for what Stones would do. They can kind of swap Stones out and just sort of go, okay, there is another piece in there. Like if I can read you, I was going through the lineups that City have played recently and just going through what position you would give them rather than the position that they play on the field, right? So it goes goalkeeper, obviously, very difficult to break that. But even then, right back, centre back, centre back, centre back, centre back, one central midfielder, right back, striker, left winger, striker. That was what they essentially started against Villa, who made them look extremely ordinary. Now, with that, I would then like to mix in that if he's asking them to play, like, first of all, that shows two things to me. He's asking them to change positions quite a lot, which I don't doubt anyone's ability. I think they're a incredibly able side. And in fact, if you've got a great coach, you become a lot more able. But I think there is then an element of, if they are being, like, he just doesn't trust the midfield is my simplest way to say it. I don't feel he trusts any of the midfielders implicitly that are in that side. I don't think he has all that much trust.
Except
Rodri and De Bruyne. De Bruyne is currently being ascribed a new hamstring. Prescribed a new hamstring, and Rodri is seemingly in and out of the side, which is massively affecting their confidence.
Suspensions and injuries.
Yeah.
And
which is massively affecting their confidence and therefore affecting the trust. Like, it's very difficult to trust someone who's not confident, blah, blah, blah.
And I feel like, you know, I mean, like, Phillips clearly isn't trusted.
Clearly, but I don't feel like he's ever been in that role. And I feel like it kind of felt like for a season, it was like, okay, well, maybe you can be a bit of a good cheerleader. Maybe you'll find your way in. Maybe when we bring in this new, more positionless or relation style football, that'll work because you're in a Bielsa team. And, you know, you made the great point about him playing for England.
So here's my question. Who is the other in world football? Rodri, like, is it that Jorginho? Like, who could City have brought in? Whose job it would have been, let's just ask the question.
No, I get it.
To play 10 games a season when Rodri is suspended or injured. And you're going to do it, not as well as him, but so it's basically seamlessly in terms of the structure. I don't know the answer to that question.
Rice might be the only other player where you go, I see the value that you bring in the midfield and what you can do for other players.
But he doesn't part, like, he's too much of a breaker-upper for me to be the Rodri type.
Rodri is very disruptive.
But his passing is better than Rice's.
Interesting. I think he might have just offended a whole load of people.
Well,
there's going to be someone with a stat where it's like, this specific pass. And also, yeah, I get it. But I get what you're saying.
But he actually is, though. Like, I can argue this preemptively. Mm-hmm. Declan Rice is a great passer. The ball has great range, long passes, short passes, whatever. But if you look at the number of passes he gets through and what Rodri's job is, it is to be the pivot to which the rest of the team rotates.
I get that.
And that requires a special passing skill set.
Well, yeah, I guess you wouldn't have said Declan Rice would... I mean, you would have said Declan Rice would play this role for Arsenal, but I guess you could make the argument that Declan Rice is being coached into the position. And if there's any manager in the world that could coach someone like Rice or Bellingham or whoever it is into the position, then it's Pep Guardiola. And, you know, maybe that is partly why Bellingham went to Madrid. It was sort of like, we want to play you in this position. You're going to be very prominent. You're going to be in this team and this team.
I think Kovacic is a much more natural replacement for Rodri. I'm not saying he's nearly as good as Rice.
I don't
disagree. He's better. Clearly, Declan Rice is actually at the stage on just a different level to Kovacic. But I think if you look at how City set up and what they ask Rodri to do, you need someone whose big attribute, I think, is like, give me the ball, I'll absorb pressure, and give it away.
But that's very difficult then to convince someone into a team to do that, because it's like, listen, you're going to be back up to my favourite player.
Spurs had this problem with Kane. It was really hard for Spurs to find a second striker who was like quality, because who wants to be behind Harry Kane, who, by the way, doesn't miss games? And Rodri, until fairly recently, didn't miss games often either.
Well, so that kind of that feeds into, I've always spoken about this with, let me just bring up a new tab here, with Harry Kane. And it's this Ewing theory idea. Do you know what the Ewing theory is?
No.
It was popularized by someone called Bill Simmons, who's a big podcaster in the States. A star athlete that receives a large amount of media attention and fan interest, but critically never leads his team to any meaningful success, leaves their team. That's very much Harry Kane. But it's kind of this Ewing theory idea, which you can take a little bit further, is like, if that player isn't in the team, and for the team almost like mentally can get beyond that player not being in the team gets better.
Juventus after Ronaldo left, I think Chiellini said, either Bonucci or Chiellini said, but we were relying on Cristiano too much.
Right.
When he left, there was a little bit more responsibility that everybody took.
So that might be the case, I think, with, that's a really great way of putting it, the responsibility, the collective responsibility that you uptake or the small roles that you pick up. You can make an argument for Henderson had that at Liverpool, where it was like the media massively focused on him, possibly quite negatively. And the other roles that people took up after he left, like Trent seems to be a lot more vocal, Van Dijk seems to be the captain now. You can make the same thing with Rodri and the kind of, you know, like how does this all fit together kind of thing? Like, you know, can we, through some of our parts, make this up?
Well, I mean, I think the most effective way to make up Rodri is to sacrifice one of those forward players, one of the five, and just play two in there. And now the interesting thing is Pep knows that's an option but doesn't want to do it because he thinks that you would lose too much.
Too much sacrifice.
Yeah, like he's basically saying it's a totally different system and I don't want to do that, which is totally understandable. But like, I wonder at what stage he has to actually have a game plan for without Rodri. Because they've lost five in a row. And if they lost 10 in a row, you think, Jesus, we need to try something different.
And they've had probably their worst start under Pep. I mean, I know someone might statistically come in and say they haven't. Pep lost his first game last night to Unai Emery. He played the guy 14 times before that, won nine of them?
22 yeah. shots to two.
Yeah, they won nine of them and like drawn four or five. So this was maybe the 14th or the 15th game. I can't remember. But as a stat, there was almost like, I told you this morning, there's almost like this parallel universe idea thing where I was like, hold on, that's like Mandela theory. In my mind, Unai Emery is one of those managers that beats Pep Guardiola. So this result made so much sense. I went, yep, that football versus that football, maybe City. And I think it speaks to the other issue that City have right now. Before, Pep Guardiola was always so respectful to Unai Emery, always so ready to go like toe-to-toe tactically because that's what Emery brings. City have been so complacent, I think, recently. So they seem to have underestimated their opponents quite serially and seem to think there's always the ability for us to come back. Now, that happened in the stadium when I was there against RB Leipzig. It was literally, I've not seen such lackadaisical football in the first half, especially when a team is 1-0 down, let alone 2-0 down in the Champions League. Now, different with RB Leipzig because City have already absolutely run that group and their final game is against Belgrade, right? So, you know, that's fine. Maybe you can afford to take a bit of a rest night. This felt very similar to that when I was watching it. And I had a few like streams going. Obviously, I've got the Liverpool game going. I've got the Manchester United game going. I've got the City game going. Pretty fascinating to look at the complacency and how evident that feels. Again, another comparison to Liverpool under Klopp last season, where people are questioning the direction of the squad, the velocity of the team, which is speed and direction, right? That is so key for me. And I feel it leads, especially after a treble, to some people stepping down. I'm not saying massively, percentage or two. And some people wanting to step away. And that's a big...
The other thing is I think they're unclear in their roles. And I think it's very easy to look a bit passive and lackadaisical when you don't quite not know what you're doing. I mean, you'll know this just like in your life, right? Like when you're very clear and you've got clarity about the thing you're doing, you attack it. Mm-hmm. And when you're slightly unclear, you probably come across a little bit more like...
Totally. Yeah, yeah. You just basically sort of go,
You're uncertain, you're trying to figure it out, and you're not quite committing because you're not sure what you're doing.
No, it leads to longer decision-making. Decision-making in football, I think what we're finding, I mean, what we know is if you can make a decision quickly, you're ahead of the opposition.
And City,
if you can be five decisions ahead, which City always were.
Exactly. And this is why I think this is the redemptive thing for City, basically.
Well done.
I think
Done you for making that argument.
I think when it clicks, they'll look a very, very different side. Also, the one other thing I just want to say about City is they seem very easy to play against at the minute. As in, teams are swinging punches at them in a way that they previously weren't. And it's because when they lose the ball, the pressing isn't quite right so you can get in. Now, again, high pressing, as we've discussed on this pod, it's a game of margins. If you're 3 yards off,
you can get a yard because the ball goes past you.
Liverpool lost 7-2, I think it was, to Villa. And the joke is the pressing was 5% off. Mm-hmm. And Klopp said as much. He was like, it happens. It's a freak result. When you play this way defensively, it can happen. I think City are like, you know, there's a golf analogy. If you hit the ball 1 millimeter away, the ball ends up radically different. I think City are essentially Fitz players, Pep twigging things without Rodri, and maybe even a signing coming in from just having executing on their much higher ceiling than every other club. The only counter argument is if Arsenal truly do kick on and their results against Brentford and Luton aren't evidence of them wobbling, but rather evidence of their strength, then I think they might just end up being too far behind by the time they do get a move on.
And that's part, and that was almost the case. That could have been the case in a lot of previous seasons where City kind of just turned it on at the right time. Their Christmas period or their kind of festive period, which I'd imagine doesn't feel too festive for them, is Luton. Then they go to Belgrade. It's pretty much a dead rubber, that one. There's then a postponed game because they've got the World Club Cup. Now, that's also interesting because previous seasons, obviously they didn't always have that. In fact, this would be the first season they've won the Champions League. But you get what I'm saying, right? That travel, first of all. It's also, I think they don't know the opponent yet. It's one of those ones where it's like, they really should go and just boss that tournament.
But it's always harder than you think. Do you remember Liverpool? Firmino scored an extra time, was it?
Against the Brazilian team as well.
It's all... because
that Sao Paulo?
My instinct says yes, but it might have been Flamengo. In fact, I think it was
Flamengo. I think we lost the World Club Cup to Sao Paulo.
But United lost it. The point being, it's like such a big game for them.
It's a distraction.
You don't know what you're doing, really. The travel's weird, the jet lag's weird. The other thing is, like, I mean, what a boost to City if they get back and Liverpool and Arsenal have dropped points all over the place. It re-energizes you. On the other hand, though, if Liverpool and Arsenal go and win all their games, you think, fuck, we're 12 points behind it.
And if you come straight back in after that postponed game, that could be like depending on the Luton game, let's assume they win it, but Arsenal also win their game. It could be like an 8-point difference between them and Arsenal at the top of the table. That's a big difference. But then they do come into Everton, Sheffield United, Huddersfield is in the FA Cup, so good week off, and then Newcastle. So
it's not terrible.
It's not terrible, but it's not like amazing. You've got Chris Wilder after a couple of weeks with the players. You saw what Chris Wilder did. He locked it down even better against Liverpool last night, though you would have expected that would be the case anyway. Everton, I'd expect City quite comfortably to beat Everton.
Where is that one?
I've not noted that down, so I don't know. And then Newcastle. Newcastle is horror. That's like, they're probably playing them at the perfect time, though there is a week between the two games, so... maybe there's that.
Newcastle, like last year, have retained some of their, God, like, why are you so intense thing? Mm-hmm. Like Newcastle, like, do you remember last year the ball was in play so rarely in their games? Because the idea was, well, if we keep the ball out of play for the 55 minutes it's in, we will go. Mm-hmm. They've retained that. I don't know if the time wasting is the same. I assume it's not because of the added on time.
Yeah, I think it is slightly different now. Though, if you got the added on time, yeah, I think they kind of learned their lesson with the added on time thing. But also, I'd imagine that they, maybe similar to the passing out from the back, you still go, it still worked like 90% of the time, so we'll still play the odds.
I think with City, like a detail I hadn't come on to, but now makes sense, is the energy with which like they come back to the Premier League. It just depends on what Liverpool and Arsenal do.
And also whether they're on the back of a win or on the back of a loss.
Like, God, because if they lose.
Right.
I mean,
it's not one game. I think it might be two. So I mean, think there's a semi-final and then a final. So.
Here's the worst case scenario for them. I mean, if they lost the Club World Cup, Arsenal and Liverpool looking great over a couple of games, and God forbid they pick up a knock, you think, Jesus, like, are we really looking over our shoulder here?
Yeah, that, I mean, especially if you look at the Premier League table at time of recording, where I think the other night, actually, Villa overtook Man City on the back of that result. If I look at the standings, yeah, Aston Villa went ahead of City.
I have to say, Villa are like, they're not what we're just chatting about now.
They can be now. I was interested to hear your thoughts on Aston Villa. I thought, first of all, I do think it was an excellent performance, but I think they were left a lot of space to be underestimated by City.
I think Villa are excellent. The worry I have about them is they look very different away from home. Like they've won 14 at home in a row in the Premier League. Mm. It's an unbelievable record. It's like one of the biggest I thought I misread the stats. Away from home, they just don't look as good. It's a big battle. They drop points against Bournemouth, but equalised late against Bournemouth. The next step for Villa, and this requires everyone to be fit, is to replicate the home form away. And it's just so much easier said than done.
Oh, like, absolutely.
If you look at Arsenal,
I saw them at Anfield.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the other detail. They got hammered at Newcastle, hammered at Anfield.
With mad injuries in that period, though.
Like, mad injuries.
Where that old theory of like you play people in the right order. Like if you play them with injuries at the right time, your result against Villa looks amazing now. Liverpool's great 3-0 against Villa looks so good compared to, you know, losing 1-0.
Yeah, and like there's sometimes stats at the end of the season being like the average position of the team you played. Mm-hmm. And there's big variations. There's teams that play like the average 15th versus like 9th. And you think those are different challenges.
Right.
And then there's the seasons where you look back and like just as a trick of memory, I feel like City Huddersfield was a fixture every single week mm-hmm. when Huddersfield were in the Premier League.
It felt that way.
And I feel like Palace and West Ham never play anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
I think with West Ham, I have always have the feeling that they are one game away.
Yeah.
I always feel like West Ham are my next match. That's, I don't know why.
Why is that so true?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I always go, got West Ham next.
Whereas I feel like Villa is a real treat. Yeah, I feel like you don't play Villa very often.
No, and like you know it's going to be a good game because Martin O'Neill's managing.
Yeah, exactly. So, and Gabby Agbonlahor is going to be running channels.
They deserve real credit, though. And I think they deserve real credit on top of that because previously the outside idea was that they were going down and down and down and down. And it was like, oh, this side isn't good enough.
To what degree does
Tyrone Mings isn't in the team at the moment, although he's not in the team because of injury, not because of...
To what degree does Gerrard look bad now? Like, or is it just a different thing?
Bad. Yeah. Do you reckon... There's a reason he's gone to Saudi Arabia, I think, at this point. I think he's kind of gone away. I think he's licking his wounds a little bit. I don't mean that in a personal sense. I just mean, like, I think he is... I think Villa was not a good fit and you sometimes just have to go away and take your time.
Do you think this is like, if you're an Arsenal fan, I mean, they're beyond happy with Arteta, but nonetheless, it's like having a girlfriend and you break up with them thinking they were a total nightmare and you run into them at a party and they're like this mature, composed, emotionally intelligent person and you go, is that the same person?
And sometimes you realise that the space helps them and sometimes you realise that maybe, and this could be the case with Gerrard, you got them one, maybe two, maybe three relationships too early and the compatibility then was so different to the compatibility now. Gerrard could come in. There are certain managers who tee up other managers. So I think that England have, the whole time with Gareth Southgate, gone, there's a possibility we win with Southgate, but there's a possibility we don't, but he's made this camp so happy, so settled, that if we bring in someone else who's just a variation and a... you know, a testosterone hit away from being Gareth Southgate, we're winning. And we're going to, but for that reason, I probably would have let him go to the last World Cup and gone, hey,
quick fire, coming up. Quick fire, quick fire. If you could have anyone, everyone, every manager in the world was free.
For the World Cup.
And you'd have England for a World Cup contract and everyone had a free, everyone wanted the job, every manager has applied. And England have to win the World Cup. Who are you taking?
England have to win it.
England have to win it in the Euros, even in Germany.
Do you have a shortlist?
Yeah, I can give you a shortlist.
I have two names, but that's just because I was thinking about them for a video not long ago. Graham Potter.
Yeah.
And Eddie Howe.
Eddie Howe. Eddie Howe's a shithouse enough these days.
I'm thinking like fit.
Yeah, yeah.
Eddie Howe is a massive shithouse. And he's, do you know what he fits the England manager profile with?
Because he's nice.
He's nice, but he's a prick.
Yeah.
So he's at the barbecue. You want to be standing with him, but also, you know, Eddie's got a bit of an edge. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, well, also the thing is that's a credit to Eddie is that no one thought he wasn't enough of a prick at Bournemouth.
Mm.
Oh, we play nice football and we're so nice and we can't see goals and we get relegated. And now he's gone to Newcastle and he's gone Kieran Trippier. So fucking
have it. Yeah, and maybe that's just because purely down to perception, size, being able to send your team out there. Maybe Bournemouth were a bit prickier than we knew, but it's like sometimes you just don't pay attention to people in the group who aren't taking the attention because it's like there's just other people in the group. And it's like Bournemouth, one of those people who were like, actually doing some pretty cool stuff. And everyone was like, that's nice. But look what's happening over here. And Bournemouth is still doing like juggling and all this cool shit. But everyone's like, wow, Man City, huh?
Can I have a moan for a second? It's a stupid moan. And I don't really mean it before anyone in the comments gets at me.
It's sports hate is what you call it.
It's Ancelotti looks like he might be going to Brazil. That seems to be the chat and they want him. And he said like, oh, my future will become clear. Why can't England get Ancelotti? How cool would that be?
For a summer.
For the World Cup. For also the next campaign.
The Bellingham thing.
Yeah.
You basically go, you did it with Jude, and we have not similar pieces, but we have a lot of talented pieces.
We have our version of Vinicius and Rodrigo
you
up front.
You can smoke at St. George's Park if you want.
It's
like,
fine.
I think that's the yeah. point where he went, I want to be able to smoke on the training field. And they went, Gareth doesn't do that. And he went, fine, I won't do it. And they went, we'll give you a little area you can smoke. And he's like, I want to be able to smoke anywhere. anywhere within St. George's Park. And they were like, I don't know about that, Carlo. That doesn't sound right. And on the sideline, the players in the interview going, nah, sounds good. Yeah, yeah.
Definitely, brilliant. That's fine.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Also, if you were just to map for a second, the Real Madrid team onto the England team, like two wingers up front with Bellingham 10, I'm going to stick like Sterling and Cole Palmer up there for all I care. It doesn't
stick
matter.
Cole Palmer up there, stick Jack Grealish one side, Cole Palmer the other. Like,
it's not about them, it's about Jude.
Cole Palmer can be Rodrigo. Jack Grealish could be the English Vinicius.
Yeah, what we need is two players. Yeah, yeah. And then it doesn't matter about who they are. I could play up there because it's all about Jude.
And then you got the midfield pieces where it's like we've
Rice
got
at the base.
Rice could be kind of Tchouaméni Camavinga-ish or Cruzy. And then you've got like,
shit, we're missing, the problem is we're missing the central midfielders in the diamond. Because Jude's at the top, Rice is at the bottom. And then it's like
Trent.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Trent. Because I was looking at the Terry Venables team the other day when we said it on the podcast, and like McManaman and Trent are so similar where they're ball carrying midfielders. And that's good. That works. And then the only thing we're lacking then is like
a left sided central midfielder.
Or a right sided one if you want Trent to be like an inverted. Can you play an inverted central midfielder?
That's where we're going. If it hasn't happened yet, it's happening soon.
Yeah. So he'd normally play right, and then if you invert him, that means he goes left. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Oh God, yeah. Yeah. Well, so, it means, I think in my mind, and this is a bit nerdy, to invert a right central midfielder would be to take the distance between the middle of the pitch mm-hmm. and the right central midfielder. You either flip it or you halve it and shift him one, nudge him to the left.
Okay, you're playing inside the inside right.
Yeah. That is, I think, at the point where I start watching another sport.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, too good.
Too much.
It doesn't get better than this, guys.
Pep's just exploded. I think it might actually happen that you could do Phillips at the base of midfield.
Declan a little bit further on.
Declan is one of the eights and Trent is one of the eights. Phillips is just like that breaker-upper sort of, I'll just sit here and I'll do the passing, but there's intensity. And if Phillips wants to swap up, I don't think he's a gone footballer. I think there's still an ability there. And I think he'll be in January. I think he'll definitely be loaned out. But I think he's still on for an England place because look at what the manager did with him. They were literally like, yeah, yeah, cool. Like, come along anyway. You've barely played. It's fine. Why don't you come and get some fitness? That works.
Alternative edgy suggestion. Drop Phillips, Rice at the base, and have Rico Lewis and Alexander Arnold.
I don't hate Rico Lewis.
And just have football utopia.
I don't hate Rico Lewis. I think Rico Lewis is really good.
Or can we just cut out the middleman and get James Ward-Prowse in? It's not going to happen.
It's one of those things where it's like Ricky Lambert for England or something. It's
do you reckon?
Like, oh, no, he's better than Ricky Lambert, isn't he? This is disrespectful. But you know what I mean, though, where it's like, who could you be? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, who are you? Like, it's maybe more like Robbie Fowler. Robbie Fowler was good, like good, good. But that Liverpool team was mid. And it was like, you know, West Ham are Ward-Prowse is good, good, good. West Ham team are mid.
But Southgate is secretly wanting us to be set play FC. So like, why can't we just...
Sorry, if your other midfielder is Trent and you're saying to me like, I don't think we're good on set pieces, and then there's another player in the team called Kieran Trippier, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
You reckon we don't need James Ward-Prowse in there quite?
Yeah, it doesn't work. It's kind of like you put in your CV and then they go, cool. So it says here you can do social media, but this guy can do social media and this, and he can do Photoshop, and he can do that. And it's like...
And Luke Shaw takes Man United's corners. So it's like you have a left footer in there as well.
And a right footer. Let's take a quick break and then I want to just give you 5 minutes of stories because that's the way the podcast works.
Story time.
Right. So I was invited to go to the FSA Awards. The A might mean awards.
The FS Awards.
Fan something awards, which might be what the S is for. It was excellent. There were many, many different people there. It was a great night in terms of seeing the talent, but also diversity within the industry. I think they're very conscious of the fact that football needs to become a more representative sport, whilst at the same time maintaining its core listenership. Which is also, I think, a memo that I read at TalkSport once. Anyway, the point being, I got there purely on the luck of someone else. I know someone called Marcus Speller of the Football Ramble, very talented guy, very good friend of mine, someone who I would call a dear friend. Someone, if you read the Football Ramble book, Marcus mentions me. So I'm in the mention of a book. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, talk to me about sitting on a table at an award ceremony with the winners of some of the best awards of the night. I get there and I'm late to Nobu Hotel. I think it's Mayfair. I think it's Mayfair, but I don't feel like that part of town's called Mayfair. It might be called something else. Not Fitzrovia. It's not Mayfair. It's just above Mayfair. Like if you know London, Mayfair for me is south of the Regent Street, Oxford Circus, or Oxford Street
thing. You got like right? Soho, and then below you have the posh bit.
Yeah, but the Soho bit is, so Soho is like parallel to Mayfair, and then above Mayfair, I don't know what that's called. I can't remember what it's called.
Fitzrovia.
It's not Fitzrovia, Fitzrovia is the other way. It's like the area where all the posh hotels are, the rich people are, it's one of the richest parts of town, right? It's where like Harley Street is and all that kind of stuff. It makes you feel a little bit sick when you go inside their houses because they are so big and they all have panic rooms, right? Anyway.
For those who didn't win the awards.
For those who didn't win the awards, go to the panic room. Anyway, the point being, I get there. And it's Nobu. People, I'm walking with Marcus. Marcus is looking great in a suit. I heard loungewear. So I didn't wear pajamas, but I did wear like a jacket, t-shirt, trousers, smart shoes. I was feeling good.
That's a trend. I love that as a balance,
by the way.
This
hair is hard to pare down, but still felt good about myself. It's a DKNY suit. Looks great. I walk in. I take a piece of sushi from a tray a man's carrying around. I also take like a little tapenade thing. It was good. I don't check a jacket because it was a particularly warm night for a winter's eve. And I go over to assess the board of tables and I'm told you're table 7.
What are you wanting when you go over there?
I have no idea because I don't know what mix the room is. Who else is standing at the board? Henry Winter.
Cool.
Chief writer at the Times, cool. Chief football writer at the Times or cool. Whatever. Now, it turns out that earlier on in my career, but like the age of 20, my first interview, one of my first big journalist interviews was Henry Winter. I went and did a series with something called, at the time, EPL Talk, now World Soccer Talk, with Henry Winter, Patrick Barkley, who after the interview was like really genuinely lovely, and Barney Rone and a couple of other journalists. I made sure they were white middle-class people, you know, just to really represent the industry. Anyway, I turned to Henry Winter and I'm like, can I just say, it's a real pleasure to see you again because you were one of the first interviews. He was very gracious, kind of passed it off a little bit, but it was sort of like, oh, thank you. You know, I hope I was nice. Yeah, yeah, you were lovely. And I was like, this is great. Henry Winter. Henry, what table are you sitting at? Table 7. No way.
Me too.
Amazing. So anyway, I sit down or we make our way through the room. Marcus is a real man about town. And I sit down. There is a chair here, Marcus. Great company. But he's next to Henry Winter. This is fantastic. This side, empty chair. Oh. Who might be turning up? Empty chairs opposite side of the table. Could be anyone good. Who sits down but one of the voices of Five Live and commentator called John Murray, one of the nicest commentators, if not the nicest man in the industry I've ever met. Lovely. Sits right there.
John Murray sat down.
John Murray sat down.
Sorry, Henry Winter and John Murray.
I was sat down and I was like, oh, shit, that's John Murray. It's like one of the legends of the game. This guy was the voice of so much of my younger footballing life. And, you know, I love public service broadcasting, even if I don't love the overall organisation of the BBC at times. Though they do get a lot of my affection. So I sat down and I had a great conversation with John Murray for the night. What happens then? But who's opposite me? It's Peter Drury. And his wife. So I'm sat at the table and I'm like, this is brilliant.
Sorry, it must be a weird thing, by the way, to like hear Peter Drury say, can you like pass the salt?
Genuinely.
As opposed to, you know, because the way Peter Drury would say something like that is like, the day of reckoning is upon us. The salt meets its dinner.
Like, but that was like, the best bit was like, the day before that on the podcast, we'd had our debate as to why, whether whether Peter Drury was, you know, over-egging it or whatever. And so I was like, mildly drunk. I was like, I'm just going to tell him. We had a conversation about him maybe over-egging his commentary or like, you know, the fact we defended him on the podcast. He seemed very grateful. He was also, I wouldn't say drunk, but like, you know.
A tad a drink.
There are a lot of people at the end of the night with a bottle of red in their hand, not a glass. And he was very, because he won best commentator of the year, very affable guy, pouring it in, just pouring it out to people. So I think he was trying to get the merriment going with his wife. So he was having a lovely time. He was very proud. Henry went to one writer of the year. We all got to applaud, and then he brought the award back to the table. John Murray didn't. I think he presented an award. So that was like why he was there. I think he was nominated for commentator of the year, but difficult against Drury. The end of the night, I'm just standing there with John Murray one side of me, Peter Drury on the other.
Sorry, this is like a fever dream. Like, this is a fever dream.
We're discussing commentary styles, and they're basically telling me why and how and who to listen to. they're telling, you know, you kind of get this insight because I'm on one side of the fence on like the YouTube-y kind of social media side. They're on the very official kind of, you know, they get a lot of insight. Everyone knows them in the industry, so they can go and just talk to a groundsman or whatever. Where if I did it, the groundsman would maybe be a bit more standoffish. So we just shared a lot of notes, really.
And what did you learn about the commentary, the art of commentary?
That's a very good question, actually. I basically just learned, first of all, in order to get up in the industry, you've got to be nice. You've got to be a lovely guy. I sort of knew that, but you know, there's certain people where you're sort of like, he doesn't seem like the nicest guy, but he's doing pretty well. Some people might look at me and feel that way. But the point is, like, it was more of an overall lesson rather than just a one-off thing where they went, do this. What I did notice was, and what I think my main thing would be, is if you're going to have a conversation with a commentator, they have other aspects to their life.
No, they don't. They're like teachers who live at school.
That's the way they get treated. Everyone comes over and goes, no way, Peter Drury, you commentated
Rooney. The
goal where, and he Drury, obviously doing very well now. Like, this is probably, you know, a hot period for him. He's been clipped up loads online. I said to him, I think that was your audition for Sky. Everyone was loving you, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, maybe, possibly that was a, you know, possibly Lawrence. Yes, and his
wife, I can't do
that wasn't a bad impression of Drury.
I can't do Drury because it's like, I can't imagine him not being like wreathed in red. Like, how does he get the bus? I mean, I can't really say this on air. I was going
to
say, right.
You don't need to get it.
Know what I was thinking.
Peter Drury.
Sorry,
have
some respect. I know. Sorry, Peter.
So it's more, he was telling me about the years when you are sort of in the wilderness of commentary almost. That felt sad or difficult. Not sad, but hard.
What constitutes the wilderness?
Well, where it's like, you know, you're hot at that time and everyone's like, we want this commentator, this guy. And then suddenly you're kind of, you know, the network you're on don't have the rights anymore. So suddenly it's like, well, we don't need you anymore. And the other network has their own guy already. And you're not resentful, but you're sort of like, that's the way it is, you know?
It's like being in office, being in the shadow cabinet, but then losing the election. It's like, right, you just lost your job.
Yeah. And so that was an interesting bit. And then it was just also interesting to see how humble they were. They were all winning awards and hosted by Victoria Derbyshire. Excellent host.
Did this feel like they were, their personalities reflected their style of commentary?
John Murray, very humble, very good, great listener. You'd have to be sitting next to me at dinner. And he was good. But it did. Although Drury felt very aware, I think, that he came across as very aware that he's now on Sky and sort of, I'd imagine if you're on Sky, you kind of have to maintain an element of distance. Or not like to the point where you're unfriendly, but to the point where if I was to go like, yeah, but you know,
him,
like they go, I don't, what do you mean by that? And I'd have to fill it in. The only general consensus, I think, was that Robbie Savage was tough to work with.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I don't even know if that was a personal bit. I think that was just things that I'd expressed that was not refuted.
Do you think?
So I can't say that Peter Drury or John Murray or Henry Winter at any point said anything negative about Robbie Savage.
It's interesting about commentators because it's a little bit like being a pundit or being a political commentator in as far as content has got shorter and shorter and more clippable or clickable, you're possibly more remembered for the one-liners and the quips.
Well, he was talking about the one where it's like from the hills of Rome, the Greek...
The Greek gods from the seven hills of Rome.
Yeah, he was saying the only thing he knew about him in that moment was he was Greek. So it was like, I went for that kind of thing. And, you know, some people like it, some people don't.
Rome has risen from its ashes.
Yeah, he was saying he doesn't like when commentators opine too much.
What does opine mean?
Just offer an opinion, whereas actually that's the color guy commentator that's meant to offer the opinion. The commentator's meant to keep you on course during the games.
On the course is a nice way to put it, because like when the Cole Palmer penalty happened, it's obviously like, oh, cool, he used to play for City, but you were kept on the course. Like the narrative is happening and the commentator's job in some ways is to keep you following the narrative in as engaged a way as possible.
But it gives you great threads to pull because like we were saying with knowing your role earlier, he knows exactly what threads he can and can't pull. And it seems like he's very aware of the spectrum of subjects that he can bring in on his own commentary. Whereas sometimes I think some people accuse Drury of being like, it felt like it's scripted or he's reading a bit of poetry or whatever. Sometimes I think it's very natural. And it's, he seems very charismatic when you're speaking with him. But what I felt was interesting was it's like some of the commentators almost feel a bit like they don't have anything prepared in the moment. And it's a bit just like, it's a goal. And now I need to come up with something. And it doesn't feel like they're great at summarizing the moment. Drury feels very good at being like, I read this in the Times and I read this in this. And you know, all the opinions around Harry Kane have been obliterated, blah, 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 blah.
But it's like this podcast, right? The preparation allows us to vibe off.
Yeah.
But without the preparation, you don't have an opportunity to be creative because, I mean, the one that he doesn't get enough credit for, in my view, is Spurs lost to a team called Mura in Slovenia. And there was this awesome thing at the end where it was like, do not begrudge them, for they have not seen days like these.
Right. And I mean, you're just like, oh, that's good.
And the line, the broadest Slovenian smile you have ever seen. And that could be prepped. It could be in the moment. But I don't care.
Mm.
The point is, like, I now appreciate Mura 1, Tottenham 0 5 times more than I did 30
right.
seconds ago.
Right.
Do not begrudge them this day of days. It's like, oh my God.
It gets you. And I think that's why he won Commentator of the Year. You know, and also, obviously, what I did realize on the night was, you know, there are storylines and threads to pull within the industry. I still feel, you know, broadly, it was a great ceremony. I thought it was really nice. Lovely hotel, lovely food, very traditional evening of that kind of food. You know, like a, I don't think it was steak tartare that we started with. Oh, it was pate. And then we had like a, what was the main? Like a steaky thing, which was nice. And then the dessert was pretty nice as far as I remember. And then they bought over some chocolates. And at the end, I presented Peter Drury with a gold chocolate because I'd saved it for him. Like an 8-year-old would save it for one of their favorite uncles at a wedding.
Which so, I think, by the way, is the relationship Drury has with most football fans in the country.
He's like that uncle that you're like, you're cool. You get it. Like he sort of goes on little trips and he's cool, you know?
And he comes back with a story about how, you know, like...
We were in Phuket. And, you know, and you're like,
I fell
were?
Off a motorbike.
Yeah.
You rode a motorbike and you fell off?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And he just relays the story perfectly. God, I'd love to be that uncle. But yeah, that's like, that's cool, you know? And he looks like his kids would be chill. And he'd be chill with his kids.
Yeah, it's an important quality for a commentator. Quality.
Let us know what your important quality of a commentator is below. Jamie now has to leave because I've actually kept him for many hours. Thanks a lot for watching the pod. I think this was really pleasurable.
It was fun.
Yeah, it was really good.
The pod was good too.
The pod was nice, yeah. Jamie bought me a cookie. But he did make himself multiple teas, so I've saved him a lot of money there in that sense. You know, it's electricity I pay for. So, yeah, thanks a lot for joining us on the podcast. Anything to plug? Is your channel uploading, or we're going to go and do the graphics soon? That's what we're doing. Great to chat to you guys. See you again real soon, right here on this channel, but also others. It's probably Monday we do the next one.
Yeah, right? And probably get your fingers sort of used to the subscribe button because the graphic will happen.
Well, you only need to subscribe once.
Well, you know, just for good measure.
For good measure, right.
For good measure, unsubscribe and subscribe.
Excellent work. Thanks a lot for joining us, guys. See you again.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.